Tuesday morning shows a Portland police officer knocking a protester off his bicycle, then arresting him. The incident took place near Lounsdale Square Park in downtown Portland. The video was posted by K2 News, and it shows the officer running towards the protester as he rode by and then pushing him over. When the bicyclist fell to the ground, multiple officers surrounded him and the man was handcuffed. The incident follows ongoing nightly protests against police brutality that have prompted the recent arrival of federal law enforcement officers. 9 people were arrested and booked during Wednesday night's protests, according to the Oregonian. Police say they were arrested for a combination of disorderly conduct, trespassing, and interfering with a police officer. Authorities also closed Chapman and Lounsdale Squares, 2 downtown parks located near the Multnomah County Justice Center and the federal courthouse. Many protests have culminated at the Justice Center. The nearby parks are a gathering place for protesters. Police reportedly began clearing the parks on Wednesday. Police say they are closing the parks because of ongoing damage resulting from more than a month of nightly protests. 2 Oregon high school students have started a campaign to remove police from school campuses in Oregon. The effort was started by Emily Zhu and Samantha Block, 2 student leaders in Oregon Student Voice, a statewide student advocacy group. The organizers took up the cause after Portland Public Schools decided to remove police, known as school resource officers, from their campuses after protesters joined the nationwide protests against police brutality. The students want their schools to do the same. The campaign seeks to remove police officers from 18 districts in Multnomah, Clackamas, and Washington counties. Right now, the group is passing a petition among districts and gathering data and student stories. The group will be providing this information to students in other districts to support advocacy efforts and help them prepare to take the request to school leadership. Portland Public Schools, Park Rose, David Douglas, and the Eugene Public School Boards have pledged to remove school resource officers. The group says its goal is to eventually remove school resource officers statewide. More than 165 people once sentenced to death in the United States have been exonerated since 1973. Now the governor of one western state is considering a death penalty moratorium to save money. Eric Galatis has more on that story.
This week, the nation saw the first federal execution in 17 years, and in Wyoming, Governor Mark Gordon announced he will consider a moratorium for the death penalty as the state struggles with the economic fallout from the coronavirus pandemic and a downturn in the energy sector. Kylie Taylor, with the group Conservatives Concerned About the Death Penalty, praised the governor's recent comments before the state legislature's Appropriations Committee.
Governor Gordon speaking out is huge. He's showing he wants to prioritize economic recovery over a failed government program that has cost Wyoming millions of dollars without any real benefit.
Wyoming is facing a $1.5 billion deficit, according to the Casper Star Tribune. Taylor says state lawmakers approved $750,000 for death penalty defense in the current fiscal year. Proponents of the death penalty argue it's an important deterrent for preventing murder and brings justice and closure for surviving family members. Taylor points to studies showing that the death penalty is not an effective deterrent. She adds that people of color are at much greater risk of being arrested, charged, and executed, especially when victims are white.
There is absolutely a racial disparity with the death penalty, and there are many statistics that show how racially biased it is. Obviously, with everything going on in the country right now, this has been a really huge topic.
Taylor says in an imperfect justice system, the risk of executing even one innocent person is too high. So far, 18 people were exonerated by DNA testing in the U.S. after serving time on death row, according to the Innocence Project. More than 165 people sentenced to death in the U.S. have been exonerated since 1973. For Public News Service, I'm Eric Galatis.
14 congressional candidates who support QAnon are on the ballot in this November nationwide. Plus, more Republicans than Democrats have registered to vote since the pandemic hit. With more on these stories, we go to Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
There's some QAnon true believers, but there's also some candidates on here maybe aren't as much of a true believer in QAnon and more seeing its supporters in the conspiracy theory as a political constituency to appeal to.
Researcher Alex Kaplan with Media Matters, a liberal-leaning media tracking nonprofit, has identified more than 60 of this year's congressional candidates who support or follow QAnon, a fringe conspiracy theory based on the idea that President Trump is fighting against a powerful group of evil politicians and celebrities who worship Satan and run a child sex ring. 14 of those candidates will be on the ballot in November. Some right-wing militias embrace the theory. The FBI warns it's a potential domestic terrorist threat. Kaplan says the developments are alarming.
QAnon is a baseless conspiracy theory. It's absolutely not true. And yeah, I mean, it has ties to violence.
Believers of the theory are planning an event in Jacksonville next month to coincide with the Republican National Convention. According to the event description, it's, quote, to celebrate President Donald Trump's nomination and eventual defeat of the deep state, unquote. Trump has repeatedly amplified Q-promoting Twitter accounts.
QAnon supporters on social media are repeatedly spreading misinformation. They are tied to misinformation campaigns all the time.
For the first time this spring, Facebook removed a network of QAnon accounts for, quote, suspected coordinated inauthentic behavior ahead of the 2020 election, unquote. But there are many more. Misinformation campaigns, some from foreign adversaries, are major threats, says David Becker from the Center for Election Innovation and Research.
The pandemic has just layered another level of concern on top of these things. And our adversaries know that we're even more fragile than we have been in the past, that there are more ways to leverage disinformation.
In the past, disinformation has directed voters to the wrong polling place or given other false guidance. Becker says getting voters registered early is the best way to ensure they'll get accurate information. But voter registrations have been way down since the pandemic began. Some of the most common methods, in-person drives on college campuses and visits to the Department of Motor Vehicles, have been largely shut down. Those who are registering have been older, whiter, and more Republican. Paige Gardner founded the Voter Information Center, which works to register young people, people of color, and unmarried women.
Millions of people every year turn 18 and become eligible to vote. And we are not providing the infrastructure to allow those people to enter into the democracy because of the pandemic. Millions and millions of people move every year. And because of the peculiarities of our system, if you move, oftentimes you have to then register to vote again in your new address, or you will not be able to vote because registrations aren't portable.
And the Trump campaign is shaking things up less than 4 months from the election. Former White House political director Bill Stepien has been promoted to campaign manager, and Brad Parscale will remain a senior advisor. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Wolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on the labor exploitation of rehab patients. At 6, we'll be hearing Rose City Native Radio. At 7, Popular Education. Then at 8, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland. Tonight's weather, clear to partly cloudy, with a low down to 62. Tomorrow's weather will be cloudy skies early, followed by a partial clearing and a high of 77 degrees. Today in history, on this date in 1945, the Manhattan Project came to an explosive end when the first atom bomb was successfully tested in Alamogordo, New Mexico. The quote of the day is from Albert Einstein, the genius physicist who said, quote, "The unleashed power of the atom has changed everything except our way of thinking. The solution to this problem lies in the heart of mankind. If only I had known, I should have become a watchmaker." Election year, there has been a huge focus on the problem of gerrymandering across the country. In one case, an amendment's been called an open door, inviting gerrymandering in. Andrea Sears has more on the story.
Critics say an amendment to the Pennsylvania Constitution narrowly approved by the state Senate on Wednesday would allow the majority party to dominate the courts. Pennsylvania's appellate court judges are chosen in statewide elections. The proposed amendment would divide the state into judicial districts devised by the General Assembly and impose a residency requirement for candidates. Sponsors say regionalizing judicial elections would make them more reflective of the state's population. But Kadita Kenner with We the People Pennsylvania calls it a Republican attempt to gerrymander the state's courts.
They could have districts that pick up more red counties, which would give them more Republican judges versus a statewide election for our appellate court.
To be enacted, the amendment must be approved by both the House and the Senate again in the next legislative session and then be approved by voters in a statewide election. Supporters of the measure say more than 60% of the state's 31 appellate court judges come from Philadelphia and Allegheny counties, which are majority Democratic. But Kenner points out that those urban counties are where the best candidates work.
These are our highest level judges in the state, and so they've worked at some of the larger law firms, some of the professors in larger schools who are able to be successful in this role.
She adds that while the judges may live predominantly in those counties, they come from several different counties across the state, and some are even from other states. The amendment passed the House late last year on a mostly party-line vote, with a few Republicans joining all the Democrats in voting no. Kenner believes the motivation behind the measure is Republican anger over rulings that have gone against them.
This started under the gerrymandering ruling and the unfair map, and this is an opportunity for them to basically seek revenge on our appellate court because they don't agree with some of the rulings that have come out.
She says partisan control of the courts by either party erodes the independence of the judiciary as a separate and equal branch of government. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
A Native Vote group will host virtual trainings. The Navajo Nation seeks E-rate funding for digital libraries, and Oklahoma's governor tests positive for COVID-19. With those stories and more, we go to Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The North Dakota Native Vote is hosting virtual trainings to inspire people to share stories about voting. Nicole Donaghy with the North Dakota Native Vote says normally they would be knocking on doors and providing information about voting in the 2020 election. But due to COVID-19, they have to go a different route.
Obviously, safety is our first priority. So we're working on a digital campaign so that people can come to us and do it from the comfort of their own home.
She says Native Americans face voting barriers in the state, and advocates don't want to reverse what they saw in 2018 with high turnout in the midterm election.
In the 2018 election, there was a gentleman that voted for his first time. He was 90 years old. His daughter brought him to vote. He wanted to vote. You know, it's also inspiring to hear when people vote for the first time why they decided to vote.
The virtual training sessions focus on storytelling, communication, and canvassing. The Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation are suing the federal government over mineral rights beneath the Missouri River on the Fort Berthold Reservation in North Dakota. The lawsuit claims the Interior Department is attempting to illegally take property. The department sided with the state over land ownership in May. Tribal leaders say the federal agency has violated its treaty and trust responsibility. The Associated Press reports about $100 million in unpaid royalties and future payments from oil development is at stake. Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt, a citizen of the Cherokee Nation, has tested positive for COVID-19. In a virtual press conference Wednesday, he says he's isolating and working from home.
I feel fine. I felt a little bit achy yesterday. I didn't have a fever, but just a little bit achy. So just did my regular testing, and it came back positive. I just want to be transparent with Oklahomans. From the very beginning, I want to share every piece of data and then let Oklahomans know exactly where we're at in our state. And I'm so proud of how we've handled it this far.
Stitt was questioned about a possible mask mandate for the state. He's been seen out in public and in meetings without one, including at a Trump rally in June. The governor says he has no plans to enforce masks, saying it's a personal responsibility up to individuals, and also leaving the decision to businesses. He's reportedly the first governor in the country to test positive for COVID-19, saying in the press conference he was pretty shocked to be the first governor to get the virus. Schools on the Navajo Nation are preparing to reopen as they examine COVID-19 response and safety plans, One of the challenges is providing internet access to students across the vast reservation amid the pandemic. The tribe's Department of Education is looking to tap into funding sources for broadband, including the E-Rate program. During a Navajo COVID-19 virtual update this week, Interim Superintendent Patricia Goney talked about the E-Rate application to set up digital libraries in Navajo communities at local chapter governments.
As a way to extend fiber optic lines to the chapter houses for internet accessibility for our students across Navajo Nation. So that work is very much in process from the IT department.
The education department is working with local school governance and school boards on reentry plans, as well as with Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah, and on the federal level. The Navajo Education Department is gathering input from families as well. No reopening date was announced following Navajo government closures, which are extended through July. In Canada, a bill requiring New Brunswick schools to teach Indigenous languages received support in a legislative committee this week, the CBC reports. If approved, the requirement would be added to the Education Act, which already includes an Indigenous history and culture teaching requirement. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Cattle farmers here in the Pacific Northwest have long called for fair market policies. Suspicions of price fixing within the beef industry have been around for years, but have intensified in 2010, leading to federal investigations. Mike Mowen reports on efforts underway by North Dakota cattle farmers who say they want a fairer market across the country.
Calls are growing louder for changes within the beef industry to create fairness for farmers and ranchers struggling to compete with larger operations. A group of producers in North Dakota says it has solutions for policymakers to consider. This week, a livestock committee with the North Dakota Farmers Union approved a series of recommendations that range from breaking up consolidated meat processing firms to reinstatement of country of origin labeling. Committee member and cattle farmer Travis Bruner says they want to feel like they're not being shut out by a system working against them.
We feel like there is a neglect being had towards the producers, and it's all going in advantage of the packing plants and the large corporations.
Industry observers say 80% of beef processing in the U.S. is controlled by the four largest companies, and producers say that creates lower prices for what they sell. It's resulted in demands from farm groups and various lawmakers to expand current antitrust investigations. The North American Meat Institute has pledged transparency in light of concerns raised over price issues, but farmers like Bruner say more accountability is needed, while adding that current conditions have created cash flow issues for him and his family. Bruner says a key component of a fair market would be increasing capacity for local and regional meat slaughter facilities.
You spread the slaughtering out amongst multiple facilities. Not only will that create a better supply and more even supply, it's going to create some demand, and then this price thing will follow through to be a little bit more true to what it should be.
Producers say the larger companies use situations such as the pandemic, along with the 2019 Kansas plant fire, as an excuse for paying even less for livestock while driving up costs for consumers. Last month, the Justice Department subpoenaed the nation's four largest beef processors. That came on the heels of indictments against several poultry executives over price-fixing concerns. Mike Mowen, Public News Service.
In June, the Portland City Council agreed to a settlement against agricultural company Monsanto over water contamination. Portland was one of 2,500 government entities involved in a $550 million settlement. According to the lawsuit, Monsanto was responsible for rampant waterway contamination from polychlorinated biphenyls, also known as PCBs. The settlement is seeking funds to rectify nationwide damage from PCB contamination. Some local governments report having spent millions of dollars on PCB cleanup. The lawsuit alleges that Monsanto knew of the harmful impacts of PCBs and hid the information while continuing to produce those chemicals that polluted the environment. PCBs have harmful effects on human health and are commonly ingested by eating fish contaminated with the toxins. PCBs have been found in stormwater, wastewater systems, water bodies, sediment, fish, and wildlife. They've been uncovered in the lower Willamette River, the Columbia Slough, and the Portland Harbor Superfund site. According to the Port of Portland, the settlement money will be used to clean up ongoing contamination. Clean air advocates are slamming a move towards renewable natural gas. As Suzanne Potter reports, conservation advocates argue that the planet has to go all electric and transition away from using natural gas for heating.
Proposals to transition from natural gas to so-called renewable gas won't solve our emissions problems, according to a new report. The report from Earth Justice and the Sierra Club is called Rhetoric versus Reality: The Myth of Renewable Natural Gas for Building Decarbonization. Sasan Sadat with Earth Justice says gas produced from decomposing lagoons of animal waste on factory farms creates too much air and water pollution, and it can't come close to meeting the current demand.
At its most, it could only replace about 13% of our total gas use. And of course, we need to get to zero emissions by 2050.
The current system of fracking natural gas and then transporting it through leaky pipelines results in huge emissions of methane, a powerful greenhouse gas that contributes to climate change. Large gas companies have begun publicizing plans to repurpose existing infrastructure to cleaner fossil gas alternatives. However, Sadat argues that we need to stop relying on gas altogether and move toward all-electric homes, buildings, and appliances.
We have to change the way we heat our homes and heat our food and heat our hot water, power them with zero-emission electricity that can benefit from solar and wind energy.
The report does support the use of hydrogen or biogas for sectors that cannot be electrified, such as aviation, shipping, and industrial steel production. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The Food and Drug Administration is warning the public to avoid hand sanitizers that may contain toxic chemicals, according to multiple media outlets. The warning comes after a rise in the number of hand sanitizers that have tested positive for methanol contamination. Methanol can be toxic when it's ingested or absorbed through the skin, according to the FDA. The FDA says there have been some cases of adults and children ingesting methanol that resulted in blindness, hospitalizations, and death. Symptoms of methanol poisoning include nausea, vomiting, headache, blurred vision, permanent blindness, seizures, coma, permanent damage to the nervous system, and death. The FDA released a lengthy list of sanitation products that have been recalled or recommended for recall as of July 15th. You can find that list at fda.gov. Despite decent winter snowfall, runoff in the Colorado and Rio Grande river basins are not looking very good. And could beavers be making climate change worse? With those stories and more, it's This Week in Water.
Could beavers be making climate change worse? That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
It's a common belief that if there's ample mountain snowfall, then there will be good water supply in the spring and summer.
But despite decent winter snow, runoff in the Colorado and Rio Grande River basins is not looking very good, and parts of those regions are now experiencing drought conditions.
Two factors have led to the current situation. First, when winter snow fell in Colorado, the headwaters for the two rivers, the soil was already dry. So when the spring thaw came, thirsty vegetation and parched ground soaked up much water, leaving less to fill rivers and reservoirs.
Then dry spring conditions made runoff happen faster. Becky Bollinger, the assistant Colorado climatologist, told the New York Times that there was a lack of snow in the late spring that would have lowered temperatures. This then led to faster melting of what snow was there, and now stream flows are struggling.
Also, as the Denver Post reports, this year's rapid snowmelt and dry conditions could increase fire danger later this summer and into early fall.
Dry conditions have also doubled the number of dust storms in the Southwest in recent decades, a situation that could have significant health consequences.
Studies worldwide have found negative health outcomes related to dust exposure, resulting in increased emergency department visits and hospitalizations.
A new study from the University of Colorado suggests that dust storms are associated with an almost 5% increase in admissions to hospital intensive care units.
Climate change can cause increased heat and drought, both of which can exacerbate conditions for dust events. Increasing dust storms have been linked by NOAA researchers to changes in Pacific Ocean temperatures.
Caitlin Rubley, one of the study's authors, told Bloomberg that the months of July and August saw the most dust storms, which is concerning because now they could strain critical care resources already stretched by the coronavirus pandemic. Beavers are remarkable engineers of riparian habitats, but in parts of northern Alaska, there's concern that the rodents' dam-building prowess might be accelerating climate change.
There's been an explosion of beavers during the last 20 years in remote areas of the Alaskan Arctic. Warmer temperatures have led to more willow and poplar growth, food the animals like to eat and build with. And they have no natural predators.
The large rodents, which can be the size of Labrador retrievers, are changing landscapes by damming streams, which leads to more lakes and ponds.
As beavers create more lakes, streams slow, and water becomes warmer than the surrounding permafrost, which has been frozen for thousands of years. Scientists warn that thawing could release massive quantities of greenhouse gases, requiring beaver habitats to be watched more closely.
The North Atlantic right whale is one of the world's most endangered species, with only about 400 remaining. And as the New York Times reports, every individual whale is known to researchers and cataloged.
The animals are dying at an alarming rate from ship strikes and entanglement in lobster and fishing gear, and their well-being is also threatened by seismic air gun blasts conducted by oil and gas companies for offshore drilling.
NOAA's Fishery Division found that to avoid extinction, the whales can't afford even a single death a year, but the agency might not be doing enough to protect the creatures.
NOAA has access to extensive science showing how humans endanger the whales. However, according to the watchdog group Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, known as PEER, internal emails show the agency aimed to put a positive spin on the outlook for the animals rather than tell the truth.
The policy director for PEER told Common Dreams that NOAA has powerful tools to protect the right whale, but it's deciding not to use them and choosing extinction instead.
NOAA has been criticized for being negligent about restricting fishing boats in areas that right whales frequent.
Critics also say that President Trump's June order permitting commercial fishing in the Marine Monument off the coast of New England has compounded threats to the endangered animals. And finally, to cool down in these hot summer days, many of us will throw back a cold one. What should it be? A lager, a stout, an IPA? The choice you make could reveal something about your personality.
According to new research out of Penn State, people who prefer bitter, pale ale-style beers, drink them more often, and perceive the bitterness more intensely are also people who seek out new sensations and who are more prone to taking risks.
To arrive at their conclusion, the researchers conducted blind taste tests and personality assessments of more than 100 beer consumers. The participants rated how much they liked and the intensity of two pale ales in a lager, as well as two bitter solutions, including quinine.
The study is not the first to link personality traits and foods. As Yahoo News reports, earlier research from the college found that sensation-seeking, risk-taking personality traits were also strongly linked to liking spicy foods, a result validated by studies done in Mexico and Italy.
And an Austrian study found that participants who liked bitter foods were more likely to show malevolent, psychopathic, and narcissistic personality traits, although the researchers noted that the findings are still tentative.
Potential antisocial behavior aside, the researchers say avoiding bitter foods can have negative health effects because often these foods, such as vegetables like kale, broccoli, and bok choy, as well as green tea and grapefruit, contain important compounds like flavanols, which have antioxidant and anti-carcinogenic properties.
The authors suggest further research is needed that might lead to new strategies to promote consumption of healthy, bitter foods.
That's it for this week in Water. We'll see you next time.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 16th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Piper McDaniel and Annette Newell. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Mike Moen, Suzanne Potter, Andrea Sears, Eric Tegadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, and Lily Bolke. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programming, including the evening news, is made possible by support from our listeners. If you would like to support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm or you can use our mobile app and click on donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth, where we will be discussing labor exploitation in rehab facilities. Stay with us.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Yeah, no, I'm really serious. I really want you guys to... I mean, there has to be laws being broke here. People working like that, I mean, that's slave labor. I mean, we outlawed slavery.
My name's Laura Starcheski. I am one of the reporters and producers on Reveal's American Rehab Project.
So during the current Black Lives Matter movement, attention has been called to the 13th Amendment, which abolished slavery except as a punishment for a crime. Prison labor is both legal and prevalent in this country, which has led to a number of boycotts of companies who use it. It's actually sort of common with what you see at the grocery store. But it's not the only way work without pay is employed in this country, if you'll pardon the pun. And one of those is what's known as work therapy through rehab facilities. And you did an investigation into that topic. Can you walk me through some of your findings?
Sure, I'd be glad to walk you through some of the findings. We had a team of reporters looking into rehabs that send people to work for no pay or for pennies on the dollar at Reveal for the past almost 4 years. And our investigation started with one rehab in Oklahoma that was sending people to work for no pay at a chicken plant. And from there, the reporters who started the project, Shoshana Walter and Amy Julia Harris, they started hearing about other rehabs. They found one in North Carolina that was sending people to work at an assisted living facility. And then they got curious about just how big this phenomenon actually is. And there's no one federally tracking how many rehabs are sending people out to work and not paying them. So our team took it on and ended up finding that about 60,000 people a year minimum go through these kinds of programs in the U.S.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a big number. It's we weren't sure just exactly what we would find at the beginning. And it's a minimum number because a lot of the programs that were on our list as potentially doing this didn't want to disclose details about how they operate, where they're sending people to work, or whether or not they're paying them. So we know that there are more rehabs out there doing this.
Right, and rehab facilities, generally speaking, are pretty majorly unregulated.
That's right. Most of the facilities on our list, we found about 300 of them in almost every single state, and most of them are not licensed. So that means that essentially there's no one checking even basic things like, are people even getting a treatment that works? Are the people in this rehab safe? Are they actually getting help with their recovery? What kind of outcomes are there? There's no one watching to make sure that the treatment is humane and effective.
And what sorts of labor did you find were included in these work therapies?
Oh my gosh, we found a lot of different jobs that people were doing. We found so many different jobs that people were doing while they were in rehab. So everything from picking cotton and pecans on a farm in Georgia to maintaining oil rigging in Louisiana to doing security at Houston Astros baseball games to building luxury apartment complexes in the Bay Area in California. So people could be working in thrift stores, they could be roasting coffee, they could be making candles and essential oils. We found a lot of dangerous jobs, people doing tree trimming without proper training or equipment, people doing electrical work without proper training, and people doing a lot of work on the and people doing a lot of work in Louisiana and Texas working in the oil and gas and petrochemical industry.
One day you might go work at a restaurant. The next day, you might go work at a place that bags up mulch, where you're throwing 50-pound bags of mulch for 12 hours. That was usually a punishment job. If you got in trouble, that's where they sent you. I did scaffold building, painting, insulation, and power washing and sandblasting. Man, out here working 84 hours a week for nothing, for peanuts.
We worked 8 hours a day from 7 o'clock to 3.
10 hours a day.
From Monday to Saturday, you work about 54 hours.
And God forbid it rains, because every day you miss for rain, you lose a Sunday. So if you get a week of rain, you're working for, 6 months straight.
And normally those would be things that are regulated by OSHA.
That's right. And, I do want to point out, if people get injured on the job and they're a rehab participant, there have been OSHA complaints and reports made about those injuries. We unfortunately even found several deaths in these kinds of rehabs where people who had been injured on the job died. And those injuries and deaths could be reported to OSHA.
Okay, but the type of training or equipment that might normally be supplied for someone doing paid work instead of work therapy are not available.
Yeah, I'm sure that there are examples out there of rehabs that, say, are sending someone in to work at a petrochemical plant and end up, giving them proper equipment, taking the time to train them, sometimes just to get into some of those jobs. You have to go through a certain amount of bureaucracy and safety training. So there may be instances where people do get proper training, but at one rehab that we looked at, the Senecor Foundation, which was running facilities in Louisiana and Texas, we found over 24 injuries going back years from rehab participants there. We found people who had mangled hands, broken backs, and even a death going back to the 90s.
Wow. So thinking about work therapy, is there evidence that it's effective? I know that it's been sort of credited as a way to try to break substance abuse in people.
There's no scientific research that shows that making people work without pay is an effective treatment for addiction. our reporting focused on the opioid epidemic because we trace the roots of these programs back to a program from the 1950s that was started and ended up serving people who were using heroin at that time when there really were so few options for them and nothing that resembled a treatment program. And what's special and unique about treating opioid addiction is that we actually do have a sense of what the most effective treatment is. It's a daily medication. And taking a daily medication when you're trying to recover from an opioid addiction can reduce your risks, can reduce your risk of death over 50%. But instead of offering people what we know can save their lives, we are turning to unproven methods like sending people to work without pay.
Right, it seems rather exploitative.
A lot of the people that we talked to for the reporting, and we spoke with hundreds of people who've been through programs like this, said that they felt brainwashed by the programs, that they felt afraid while they were in them, and they were afraid to leave, and that they felt dehumanized, that they weren't valued. The psychological distress that being put in a program like this can cause, I really don't think you can overestimate it.
Well, we used to tell people, yeah, we brainwash them because their brain is dirty. And it is. It's full of heroin and morphine and wine and whiskey and cigarettes and lying and cheating and stealing. Yeah, we brainwash them.
At times, I felt so trapped.
This place took a real mental toll on me. I felt like I was a slave there.
It's almost like they try to literally brainwash you.
I remember saying I would stay there 3 months. That was it. I would have this figured out. I stayed in Senecor 11 years. 11 years. I stayed there under a dictator named Luke Austin.
Would it be fair to say to your mind that it's a problem with the system rather than a few abusive actors taking advantage of this work therapy situation?
I think overall it is a systemic failure that's led to the conditions that lets these kinds of rehabs thrive. And I would point to a couple of factors in that. One is the rise of mass incarceration coming out of the war on drugs. So we went from tens of thousands of people in prison for drug charges to hundreds of thousands of people in prison for drug charges. And that led to overcrowding and situations where many courts are looking for somewhere else to send people and to put them, either for benevolent reasons so that they can actually get treatment and get the help they need, or simply because their prison and jail system is overcrowded and overtaxed, and they just can't keep accommodating so many people. So what we really found was a prison to rehab pipeline, because a lot of people end up getting court ordered into these programs. And when that happens, it means that they may have a felony charge hanging over them. They may have years or decades in prison hanging over them if they do not complete the program. So it kind of adds a whole layer of vulnerability and exploitation to the equation. And then the other structural issue is that there was a Supreme Court case showing that this setup of sending people in rehab to work and not paying them is illegal. It violates the Fair Labor Standards Act. And even if you are giving people room and board in exchange for their work, you still need to pay them a minimum wage. Yet the Department of Labor has barely enforced the Fair Labor Standards Act with rehabs like this. We found only a handful of times when they investigated and found violations at work-based rehabs. And then when they did find violations, we found that the follow-through was missing. So even if back wages were owed, they were not paid out, and rehabs were allowed to continue to operate in this way.
So in researching rehab facilities and work therapy, did you come across common misconceptions that people might have? Or what, it, I guess put another way, what is it that most people may not understand about this issue?
I think in general, there's a tendency to treat people who are struggling with addiction in this country as if they have some kind of a moral failing. And that's the basis that a lot of these programs function on, that there's something wrong with you. If you are using opioids or other drugs or drinking, and that you need to be taught to operate in some more moral fashion.
The vast majority of folks that I deal with are basically bottom feeders. They've been losers since the day they were born. They had a crackhead mama and a dopehead daddy, or no mama or no daddy. They kicked them out of church, they kicked them out of Little League. They've never achieved anything and don't know how to achieve it. They're basically looking for the perfect welfare state where the do-gooders take care of them.
Instead of treating addiction as a medical problem, one doctor that we spoke with who specializes in addiction medicine made a great analogy that I think explains it. You know, we wouldn't take someone with cancer and say that they have a moral failing and being made to work for no pay will somehow teach them how to overcome their cancer. We know that there are proven treatments to help people, especially with opioid addiction, and those can be delivered in a healthcare setting. They don't even need to be delivered in a residential treatment facility. Studies have shown that just the daily medication, taking a daily medication, what's sometimes called medication-assisted treatment, medications like buprenorphine or methadone, that those medications reduce your risk of dying of an overdose, and you don't even have to be in a facility to take them. So I think, you know, treating addiction like it's a moral failing leads to people being put in these kind of exploitative situations where they sometimes spend years of their lives. They don't complete the programs. The graduation rates at one of the rehabs we really focused on that I mentioned, the Senecor Foundation, less than 8% of people going through that program graduate. And when you don't succeed in a program like this, you're very vulnerable to relapse and you're very vulnerable to overdosing and dying. So those really are the stakes, life and death.
So for folks who might be hearing this and, you know, are alarmed by the impact that this can have, what is there to be done about it? What action can folks take?
I think education is a big one. You know, before we did this reporting, there was no national list of rehabs that are sending people to work and not paying them. People can go on our website at revealnews.org and find that list. If you just look up the American Rehab Project, you can find it. And you can at least now get a look at how many of these programs are operating in your state. You can search by state and find out what's near you and what's happening. And if you're alarmed by this, I would recommend getting in touch with your lawmakers, your representatives, and letting them know that you find this to be an exploitative model and you think that there needs to be more regulation of the rehab industry.
Do you have any closing thoughts for us before we wrap up?
I think I would just offer a closing thought to people who are dealing with addiction and families who are dealing with addiction, which is just to, you know, if you are seeking help for yourself or for a loved one, I would just encourage people to ask if rehabs that you're looking into use evidence-based treatment methods and to take the time to ask about their success rates, whether they're a work-based rehab or not.
Okay, well, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
I was glancing through your Senecor booklet, and I liked the very first sentence I read.
In all the years that Centocor has been in business, rehabilitating lives, we have found that nothing works as well as work itself. And work is therapy. You feel better about yourself when you have something productive to do.
Laura Starcheski is a senior editor at Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX. Special thanks to Laura and the team at Reveal for use of some of their reporting. Their new serialized investigation is called American Rehab. You can hear it by subscribing to Reveal wherever you get your podcasts. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM.
You're listening to Rose City Native Radio, Low Res Edition. We have music, a talk.